Hey, welcome back to The End of Religion, a podcast where we are exploring the subversive spirituality of Jesus. My name is Bruxy Cavey.
I'm Tim Day.
And Tim and I are hanging out together, walking through chapters of the book, The End of Religion. We're not just regurgitating the information in each chapter, but we're using each chapter as a springboard just to discuss some of the issues that it raises. And it's been a while since our last chapter, but now we are at chapter 11 called Sacred Space, Redefining the Temple. We're probably now today going to be approaching the topic, Tim, that got Jesus killed more than anything else. I mean, this was kind of the straw that broke, it was the 2x4 that broke the camel's back, right? It was a huge issue. It comes up at Christ's trial at the end. It seems to have been the thing that got the religious leaders of his day most nervous, was his attitude towards the temple, his prophecies against the temple.
Yes.
And this was, I mean, this was the thing they said, well, okay, you don't interpret Torah in keeping with our tradition, and you don't actually honor our traditions the way you should, but don't touch the temple. Now this guy's got to die. So we're really kind of getting a window to the extremism of Christ's spirituality when we walk through this chapter together.
Yeah, there's something probably innately very human and physical about this whole aspect of spirituality, in that it's almost like, I can say, animals staking out their territory. Right? That there's an element to that, because I think when you conflict with somebody philosophically, it doesn't feel quite the same as when you touch their space personally. Right? Like, if I just disagree with you in concept, that's different than you coming over and kicking over my dinner room table. And there's something about sacred space that has that added element of personal ownership. Do you know what really strikes me about this? I actually encountered this recently. Not recently, a couple of years ago, where I had a chance to see the importance of sacred space in a way that I haven't really seen it before. I was doing a wedding, and I was in one of these beautiful cathedrals, and someone had rented it to do a wedding, and I went up to the front. I was the pastor going to lead the wedding, and as often happens at the front of churches, they are all set up for Mass or for their service, particular service that they're hosting. And we need to do some reorganization to allow the wedding parties to stand in proper locations and all that stuff. So there's a table at the front that had this big, huge Bible on it, a Bible that I don't know if anybody read out of it. To me, it looked like a decorative Bible. And so I went up and was walking towards it to move it, because we need to move the table. All of a sudden, someone shouts to me, "Don't touch the Bible!" And I'm like, "What?" And I'm looking around, and I was informed by the person there assisting me on behalf of the church that there's only one person in the congregation who had they were like the deacon who cared for the Bible. And you literally had to call this deacon in to move the Bible. Because nobody else, not even the pastor, not even a visiting pastor, could touch the Bible.
Wow.
Because it was God's sacred holy word. And that was their way, of viewing their space as sacred, and that as a sacred icon.
Right. So the Bible itself becomes a place of sacred space within. And it, my guess is it probably just wasn't sitting on any ordinary table either.
No, it had a very decorative table that was designated just for the Bible.
Was that the altar, do you think, within that church's context?
I think it would have been the altar. It was positioned centrally,
and
the pulpit was to the one side. And so I think it was, in a sense, I think when they did Holy Communion, they would have put the elements on either side of the Bible.
I
think it would have been called the altar.
For people who aren't part of a church culture, haven't been raised in church, you should know that a lot of churches, and certainly churches I was raised with, have their own version of sacred space. So the building itself is called the church. Then within the church, you have a room that you meet in on Sundays where you have the service, and that's called the
sanctuary.
That's right. And at the front of the sanctuary, you have a special table called the
altar.
And
An altar rail, even. They'll sometimes have an altar if your tradition is coming to the front for prayer. They'll have the altar.
And then on the altar often would be a special version of the scriptures. And
nice big thick Bible.
And it's almost creating its own concentric circles of getting closer and closer to the Holy of Holies. Except that the center of the Holy of Holies, you have a book. You have the Bible.
Oh, that was totally my experience growing up. I grew up in a church that I remember this specifically, whereas, you know, young kids and we're playing and we come running into the sanctuary,
Right.
and they shout, "Stop!"
Yeah.
You had to be quiet
right.
and walk carefully,
yes.
especially at the front,
yeah.
until you pass. And when we got halfway down the center aisle,
yeah.
you take off again.
Then when you're finally on your way out the other door. Yeah, don't run in the sanctuary. And so there was this sense of God's presence is somehow here in a way that demands more respect than anywhere else.
Definitely.
I mean, don't run in church in general, but especially when you go into the sanctuary. And sanctuary really is a concept borrowed from the Old Testament of meaning the dwelling place of God. This is where God's manifest presence, certainly God's presence is everywhere, but his manifest presence would be more closely experienced at a particular
That's
place.
Right. That's right.
And there is a reality to that in the Bible. It's just that it's the Old Testament part of the Bible, right? Where God would kind of show up in a special way at a specific locale, and people would have a sense of his presence, or they'd hear his voice in a way that would be like trumpets blasting.
Yes, yes.
Or there'd be a pillar of cloud or a pillar of fire or a burning bush.
Yes.
And that's something that God would do at times throughout the Old Testament. But there's always this promise that in the New Covenant, his Spirit's going to be given to everyone. He's going to dwell on the inside. The teacher's going to come along and whisper in our ear
yes.
and tell us where to go. It's not just going to be about the book itself or the Torah or the law or the covenant of print and page, but the covenant with the person himself, the
That's
teacher
right.
himself, not just the teaching, but the teacher will come and walk yes. with you. So there's always this promise that God's going to be everywhere and you're going to experience him everywhere through the power of his Spirit. But we, as new covenant people, still often revert back to old covenant styles.
Yeah, this concept of sacred space seems universal.
Mm.
It's part of that human condition of us trying to save ourselves and to connect, I think, with the greater divine reality.
Yeah.
You know, if you even think of looking at ancient civilizations, they always created sacred space.
Yeah.
And it might be a special mountain.
Yeah.
It might be just something that stands out, like a protrusion of a rock, just something that would capture your eye and look different, look somehow unique on the landscape, was a good candidate to be all of a sudden turned into some form of sacred space, into some place of trying to connect with the divine.
Yeah.
And it seems, it's probably in the psychology of humanity, we inherently feel defective.
Mm.
And so by creating sacred space, it's a practical way to psychologically work with ourselves to feel like we've connected with God.
Right.
It's sort of like, if I know God is here,
yeah.
right, even though I don't feel like he's with me
right.
hardly ever,
yeah.
I can create this emotional experience by going back there to feel like I've connected.
Back to that place where I first met with God, I can go back there again and again.
And I can connect. And it allows me to be more comfortable with my disconnect.
Yeah.
All the rest of the time,
yeah,
right?
Right, right. Because that's the corollary is on the converse is that when I'm not at that place of sacred space,
I've got some distance.
I've got some distance between me and God. He's not watching so closely. And that's
not a bad thing if you have stuff that you want to do,
right?
Right. But if you think about it, if I've got some stuff I want to do,
yeah,
and I know God's over there.
And you're right. He's not
right?
watching. You've got his back turned.
You've got a little bit more of a leash, right, to go do something,
right.
And so there is something almost comforting
yeah.
about sacred space in that
both being there and being away from
being
it.
Being away from there.
And keeping God under control.
His
nearness to you is something you can control
because
he's stationary. You go visit him once a week. Whatever.
He's our captive.
Right.
Religion,
yeah.
in a sense, wants to make God captive.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Sort of put him in a container
yes.
that we can manage.
Yeah.
That's what religion does over and over again,
yeah.
right? It's
right,
like whether
right.
it's our theology, we've captured him.
Yeah.
Or in this case, a building.
Yeah.
Hello, let me out.
Do you know, it's interesting because some people will say, you know, but I do feel closer to God when I go to certain places. And I think we're not trying to say that's necessarily always a bad thing. Some ancient writers used to talk about what they called thin places, were places where they felt the veil between the human and the divine was thinner than it might be otherwise. But my sense is what we might call a thin place, what we would say is a place I go where I feel closer to God is saying more about us than it is about that place. It's saying I think if we're acknowledging that, then it's okay. If it's saying I tend to feel closer to God when I'm out in nature, or I feel closer to God when I'm at a church gathering on Sunday, or when I sit in this usual room where I have my coffee and read scripture and I pray, I feel closer to God. That's okay because I'm saying it's a thin place for me, and that's because that's how I'm wired. But once we start to then turn that into almost a form of magic where we're
right.
saying, no, God is more present there. I feel closer to him there because he is there more.
That's
God
right.
is in nature more than
That's
he is
right.
in a building. He dwells in the country more than he does in the city. Or he dwells at the church sanctuary more
right.
than he does in the parking lot. At that point, now we're taking our own psychological projections, and we're reshaping God
right.
in based on our psyche.
Once again, you know, as soon as you press, it's excellent points you're making, Brooks. Once we press our relationship with God into the mold of a true relationship, mm. it'd be like you and I sometimes when we're hanging out together. Mm. There's sometimes when we're just plain working,
yeah.
right? And
mm.
we're like in a management team or whatever. Mm. And I would say, how, like, do I feel like the best friend of Brooksy? Mm. It's like, well, we're working, we're doing stuff together.
Yeah.
Then there's times when we go on a trip, right? And
yeah.
we're hanging out, and
yeah.
we're in an airport,
yeah.
or and we're very distracted. There's a million people around.
Yeah.
Then I feel like, oh, man, I just want to get from point A to point B.
Yeah.
And then the next leg of the trip, we're stuck in a hotel room at night
yeah.
watching movies and
yeah.
killing ourselves laughing.
Wait.
And then I feel like, man, it does feel like I'm so connected to Brooks. It's
yeah,
just
like,
an awesome
here's
friend.
Here's our friendship. Our friendship is rich.
Right.
Yeah. But that's about our experience. It's not about the magic of that
room
that we happen to have that experience in.
A lot of times it's the focus.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when people come into sacred space, what they're actually doing is mentally and emotionally focusing.
Right.
And so they feel it.
Yes.
When they go out, they're not focusing. Doesn't mean God's there or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
It's we're there or not. We're becoming present to God, really.
Right.
Yeah.
And you think of the Old Testament passage that said, be still and know that I'm God.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
It is actually for many people, it is stillness, not sacred space, that connects us to God.
Right, that's your thin place. It's slowing down enough just to become aware of what is true at all times in all places.
All places.
You're just finding the context in which you can become the most aware of it.
Right.
Which, again, is a fine thing, but don't then project that onto God as though he's more present some places
that's
rather
right.
than others. The new covenant has actually come, and God has been fully indwelling his people around the world at all times in all places.
Right, and I would say, again, in that relational context, it's not only to be cautious that way, there is a danger, inherent danger, with over-attaching to that concept of God being more accessible to you in this retreated sacred space, in that you could then lose, ultimately, God's purpose for your life, for you to live as an expression of God's grace to the world, because you're always sort of feeling disconnected and then always wanting to run to that sacred space to say, this is when I'm really intimate with God. It's sort of like the child at home, right?
Yeah.
Who always wants to run home and be close to mommy or daddy, right?
Yeah.
But then is never really goes out to live life as a deeply loved and empowered new child growing into their maturity.
Yeah.
And so there's something about, I think, God saying it's okay to start with, you know, quiet places.
Right. Yeah.
Of relationship building.
Yeah.
But don't make that the destination. Right? Make that the launch pad.
When you're healthy, you go out and you take the joy of family and of psychological well-being and emotional well-being and safety and security. You take all that with you then wherever
That's
you
right.
go. And your focus becomes the service of others.
And you recreate, actually,
yes.
for other people,
right, right.
sacred space or relational space.
That kind, right, right. Well, in that sense, in the New Covenant, the sacred space is wherever two or three are gathered.
That's right.
If I do feel that I need some assistance in becoming more aware of the presence of God, Jesus says, okay, great. Find a brother or sister in the faith.
Yes.
Hang out with them, right?
Yeah.
They bring the Spirit with them,
That's
just
right.
as you do. And find me there.
That's right.
There's some passages listed in the chapter where in the New Testament it talks about the people, plural, gathering together to become the temple, singular, of God. That we're like living stones. And yes, the Holy Spirit in the New Testament is said to indwell individuals, but he also, in another sense, indwells the body corporately.
Yes.
So that when we're gathering together, he's kind of in the midst. He's in the matrix of our relationships back and forth.
That's right.
That's where if we want to experience God more, then it drives us towards relationships, not just away from people into solitude.
You know, when you say that, it strikes me in the very first page of that chapter 11,
right.
you have the concentric circles of the Old Testament, Old Covenant view.
Yeah, right.
And what you're saying there makes me think of that because really the religious system, as you mapped out here, page one, it says Israel, the sense of promised land, was the first sort of concentric circle of sacred space.
Yeah.
Are you in the promised land
right.
or are you out of it?
Right.
So it's very geographic. Then within the promised land was this city.
The sacred city.
The sacred city, the city of peace or the city of shalom,
that
inclusive word of wellness and whole being, overall well-being and, and health.
Wholeness. Yes.
Wholeness.
Yeah.
And then within that was the temple,
which
was the place to connect with God where this pillar of fire would descend, right?
Yeah.
As a manifest, as you said, presence of God.
The manifest presence of God.
And then within the temple was the most holy of holies.
Yes, the most holy place.
Which was this such an incredibly sacred space that only the high priest could go once a year.
Yes.
To offer the symbolic sacrifice, the blood.
So the closer you got to the center, the more people were kept. It was like a filter. The more people were filtered out, the closer you got to the center.
Right. The more, you had to be of such a righteous standard.
Yes, yes.
And so even in the temple,
even to get to the temple, only Gentiles could only go to the outer court.
And then only women.
Then women could only go one step in, but then they were prevented. So then if
Jewish women
could go one step further than the Gentiles of either gender, but then they had a filter that caught them.
And then the men.
Jewish men. But then you just have the priests, and then eventually the high priest.
So there's this intentional gradation that was reminding, actually, not people of intimacy with God, but it was a way of reminding that in a sense, nobody, it was almost like a reverse psychology.
Yeah.
It wasn't a system to show us how close we were with God.
Yeah, right.
It was a way to really sort of screen it out, map it out, to say how far we all are.
Yeah.
Now, just to be clear, you know, Gentiles aren't further from God than Jewish men or women.
Yeah.
God was working with their own preconceived ideas and just simply graphing it for them and saying, here's a way to graph it out.
Well, and certainly when kids are younger, you need more graphic, vivid illustrations. You need tight boundaries and lines of what's right and what's wrong and what's appropriate and what's inappropriate to become kind of these living lessons for them.
Yeah.
But you hope they will grow up and take those lessons then into the rest of their life and not just try and duplicate the fences.
That's right.
Our youngest just started crawling on the weekend and our whole life has changed. Now we're on the internet.
A moment of silence.
Yeah, we're on the internet trying to buy used fences, the baby fences, because we've got a lot of stairs in our homes on every level.
Right.
And you put her down for a second, and
there she goes.
So, but those fences are good. They're wonderful. Boundary keeping, all great.
Mm.
But it's not our hope that then she will learn
that
those fences prevent her. Our hope is she'll get old enough that she can walk right over those fences.
That's right.
Won't need the fences. Her own babies can have fences.
Mm.
But there's just developmental stages with humanity, as Galatians tends to explain it. That we've talked about this in previous podcasts, but it applies here again to the way God set up the temple for the old covenant, but then pushes through that when
he brings
us into the new covenant.
Yeah, and when you see those concentric circles on the first page, you can see how just immediately the whole planet almost was excluded on the first boundary.
Yeah, right? That's right. That's right. You have the Holy Land and then just the rest of the world.
The rest of the world.
They're just out there.
And so there's, the whole point of this thing, like you said, was creating these, just making it crystal clear. Look, nobody's going to get in.
Right.
It doesn't matter who you are. Even if you're the top priest guy.
Yeah.
Even you do not end up in daily intimacy with God. Now, the interesting thing in the Old Testament, you have planted both men and women, Jews and Gentiles, these great, while this whole picture is being played out, these rare exceptions, where all of a sudden somebody who doesn't fit this gradation is just a straight-on friend of God.
Right. There's a hero or there's a friend of God. There's someone who doesn't fit into the boundaries.
Boundaries. And they're just doing things that you're not supposed to do.
Yeah. They become hints of what's to come. Well, and also, too, we have to remember...
Like little clues.
Yeah, little clues. We have to remember God didn't start with the old covenant. He didn't create the world and say, you're now under the old
covenant.
That's right. One day there'll be a new. He starts before that with Adam and Eve.
That's right.
And the whole planet is his place.
That's right.
And he creates all of it, and he says it is good. All of creation is good. So we start with the whole world being the Holy Land. You know, it's all sacred.
And
it's only later then when God has to train Israel in meticulous lessons that then the boundaries are set up
fully, and I fully believe that the Old Testament is, as we've said before, is mapping it all out for us so we can see it clearly. One of the biggest problems we as humans have is we live instinctively or intuitively out of our own self-centeredness. And until you see it mapped out on the wall, and you bang into those fences, does it become practical and hard? It's as we used this illustration before. When working with an addict or a group of addicts, I've heard people from AA say the very first thing they'll do is map out for them everything they've tried that doesn't work.
Mm.
Only then can they begin to embrace and accept that what does work is very counterintuitive. Yeah. Here in this whole concentric circles, what's beautiful is when Jesus comes and then in the the explosion of the new church, these concentric circles are completely reversed.
In so he doesn't just dissolve the concentric circles. He reverses the trend completely.
He inverts it. And so in the if you read about it in the Acts chapter 1, 2, and the chapters following, the believers come together. This fire descends as it did in the Old Testament, not on the Holy of Holies.
Right.
Or on the altar.
Just in whatever space they happen to be hanging out in.
Onto their lives. And they become then the Holy of Holies. Yeah. Their own lives become the Holy of Holies. Their community becomes the temple.
And then they don't say, now let's erect a new temple on the place where this event happened.
No.
Yeah, right.
They become an organic, living, almost like viral temple
that then
spreads out. And as you read through the book of Acts, whether it's Jerusalem or the other cities across the Roman Empire, as they start to expand out, they'll talk about, in that city was great joy. And this shalom of Jerusalem is no longer just one city on the planet, but the good news, this great message, starts being carried to cities.
Yeah.
New communities are included, welcomed, and then no longer is it the promised land of Israel, but the mandate in Acts chapter 1, 7 and 8 we see mapped out, right?
Acts 1, 7 and 8, Jesus says,
you'll receive power when my spirit comes in you, and you'll be my witnesses, or the carriers of my message and life change.
Yes.
To your own city,
to
Judea and Samaria, which is your own country, and then to the ends of the earth. And so these concentric circles are completely inverted, and it says, now you are sacred space, your lives, your friendships are sacred space.
And don't be content to just celebrate that, but carry it outward. Expand the circles.
Be carriers of my sacred space into the world.
Yeah.
And you're creating sacred space wherever you go.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, welcome people into it. Because it's accessible to everyone.
So under the Old Covenant, you have people trying to get to the center where God is, and there being filter mechanisms all along the way. The New Covenant actually starts with you at the center. It's like God will meet you wherever you are at, there. You've done it.
Yeah.
There's no religious mechanism. You don't have to keep striving to get close to God. You start close to God, and God can fill you with His Spirit right here and there where you're at. Jesus is with you. He says, and you know, lo, I go with you always, even to the ends of the earth. So He promises to them at the end of Matthew when He gives the Great Commission, go and spread this, and I'll be with you. So you're hanging out with me, and I'm going to continue to hang out with you by the power of the Spirit. So now you carry this outward. You've already achieved.
Yes.
You know, the first day of your life as a Christian, you've achieved everything the Old Testament is trying to accomplish. So now just go and spread that out to everybody else.
Exactly. It'd be like somebody living their whole life saying, oh, if I could just by the time I'm 65 earn $1 million.
Yeah.
And then God as Father comes to you and says, do you know what? Let me write you a check for $100 million and just go give it away.
Yeah.
Right, you know what I mean?
Right. Now what do you do? But my whole life was built around the goal of trying to earn $1 million.
He says, it's a waste of time. Yeah, you know, and when you're done with $100 million, come back. I'll give you another $100 million. Yeah. I got so much money I want to give away.
Yeah.
And that's what he does with this connection with intimacy with Him, friendship with Him, the sense of grace, forgiveness, restored relationship, right? Yeah, yeah. He wants to start us, you know, and it's not even, I would say it's even beyond, even in the Old Testament, there's only one guy in all of Israel who, you know, one day a year could duck in and duck out with a rope tied around his ankle,
right?
It blows it so far off the map
that
He takes us so far into that place of intimacy and security with Him. That, you know, He wants to fill us up. I think of Ephesians chapter 3 and Paul's praying. He says, I pray that you might be filled to the height, to the depth, to the width, to the length, of the breadth of the love of God.
Yeah.
That you might be filled to the fullness of Christ and that image. And it's that, that sense of overflow being just blown away with the presence of God invading your life. That then you get to carry that out. It's not a selfish thing. Actually, the thing that you've always wanted, God wants to satisfy, so that then you can truly become other-centered, securing your relationship with Him, and then just go take that sense of divine presence wherever you go. It's an amazing vision.
That's terrific. So part of what Jesus has to do in order to fully inject this vision into people's souls so they actually catch it is He has to help them disengage from their current addiction to the temple in Jerusalem.
Yes.
I mean, he can paint this picture and
And there's the danger of painting this picture and people saying, hey, that's really great, and we'll try and reach out for that vision, while at the same time we maintain our temple here and our sacrifices, because we do have something special on the go here. And so he really has to challenge their old mentality of the old covenant if he's going to at the same time welcome them into a new mentality in the new covenant. So you see him at odds with the religion of his day on this specific issue, and that means Jesus and the temple are at odds. It's representing a sacrificial system that is no longer necessary once Jesus comes on the scene.
Yeah, and you make some excellent points in that. I'm just looking at page 135, where you talk about him being a one-man walking, talking counter-temple movement.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't because he hated religious leaders. Yeah, it's like trying to free people, like
right.
you said,
yeah.
free them from that addiction. Unless yeah. you pry your fingers off mm-hmm. of what you have in your grip, you'll never receive anything new
yeah,
in that hand.
Right.
And so he was intentionally offering forgiveness,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Where the temple is only supposed to offer forgiveness.
Yeah.
He was declaring the kingdom of God is among you,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
when people thought they had to draw near to God in an actual
right.
location.
Right, yeah. So Jesus, when he actually goes into the temple near the end of his messianic career, he turns the tables over. He challenges the system.
I love it you say he throws a temple tantrum.
You know, they might expect him to show up and to bless the temple, and instead he really curses what's going on there anyway.
Yes.
And sometimes in churches, I think that gets trivialized to saying, you know, Jesus didn't like the fact they were charging too much money for the sacrifices, because that in the temple courts, that's where you could go and buy your sacrifice. If you didn't bring one with you along
yes.
the way, if you had to travel a few days' journey, it's possible that the lamb you're bringing for sacrifice could get damaged or could fall down or you could lose it. So you could just go to the temple and buy a sacrifice there. So it's really convenience. It's religious convenience. And some people say, well, you know, they were charging too much money, or they were charging interest, or the money changers were making money. They're trying to get rich on religion. So Jesus wasn't really against the system and what was going on in the temple. He was just against the way they were doing it, that they were trying to get rich on it, and that's the problem. And somewhere that gets diluted down to, I don't know, you shouldn't go shopping on Sundays or something like that. You know, they're just, you shouldn't have a bookstore in the church or something like that. But there's so much more going on here, because as John recounts it in John's gospel, Jesus is not just turning over the tables of the money changers, but he's driving away all the sacrificial animals. He's sending them out with a whip. You know, he's
yes.
just clearing the temple of all kinds of animals.
He's not whipping the people, by the way.
No, that's right. People have to say, well, Jesus, sometimes just war theorists. He was violent.
He whipped people.
Look at that. No, John, who talks about him using the whip, says he's driving out the animals. So let's just be fair about that. So he clears the place of all of their potential sacrifices. I mean, because
yes.
the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world has just walked into the temple.
That's right.
There's no need for this entire system to continue to do its thing. And he shuts down the gig. And he also challenges them. He says a few things. He says, my Father's house should be a house of prayer for all
nations. That's right.
And at the time, they had those concentric circles within the temple filtering out the Gentiles. In fact, the marketplace where you bought all of your animals was in the court of the Gentiles.
That's right.
So the one place where Gentiles were allowed to come and pray was the place that they had decided, well, let's just use this for the market.
That's right.
It's a way of saying, I mean, legally you Gentiles can come here, but
we're not creating space for you.
No, we're not giving you any consideration for your spirituality. And so Jesus emphasizes
yes.
it should have been a place for all nations in the first place. And then he challenges them on their mentality toward the temple, how they're using
yes.
it. And he quotes from the prophet Jeremiah.
That's right.
And it seems to be a mentality that God in the Old Testament was already challenging Israel.
That's right.
And again, it's not a different God between the Old and the New Testament. Same God, same heart, wanting to communicate the same message, just using different mechanisms based on what we're ready for throughout our history. So it's worth going back to that passage. It's on page 136, Jeremiah 7.
Yes.
This is a passage Jesus quotes from. So it ties together the rebuke of Jesus to the religious institution of his day and what was God's same heart and same frustration with his people back in the days of the prophet Jeremiah. So I thought maybe we could just read through that passage and ask the questions, what is he saying here and what are the transferable lessons for us today? Because are we in danger of falling under the same rebuke in our relationship with sacred space? How about I read it from a different translation so people
sure.
who have the book can follow along and compare? It's in the New Living Translation in the book. I'm going to read it from a different one. I'll start with Jeremiah 7, verse 3. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your deeds, and I will let you dwell in this place, meaning this entire land. Do not trust in deceptive words, words like, this is the temple of the Lord, this is the temple of the Lord, this is the temple of the Lord. Those are deceptive words. And it's interesting he calls them deceptive. It's just stating a fact. This is the temple of the Lord. And he's saying, no, just remember, I may have built a special place, a thin place where you sense my presence more, but don't contain me to this. You know, don't fall in love with that structure. Those are deceptive words. 4, verse 5, if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, if you truly practice justice between a man and his neighbor, if you do not oppress the alien or the foreigner living among you, or the orphan or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, nor walk after other gods to your own ruin, then, if you take your religion out of this place and into the streets.
Right.
If you stop falling in love with this sacrificial system and you get out there into the streets and you start to live in a way that blesses other people and welcomes in the people who others might want to shun, then I will let you dwell in this place and in the land that I gave you and your fathers forever. Behold, you are trusting in deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, and commit adultery, and swear falsely, and offer sacrifices to Baal, and walk after other gods that you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered, that you may do all these abominations? Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your sight? Behold, I have seen it, declares the Lord. So he says, even back in the time of Jeremiah, this temple has become a den of robbers or a den of thieves. As we point out in the chapter, then a den of thieves is not the place. Again, that ties in with the economic interpretation that some Christians have given Jesus turning over the tables in the temple. Say, well, they were trying to steal money. They were trying to make too much money. That's why he was upset. And they say, look, Jesus called it a den of thieves, based on Jeremiah in his day calling it a den of thieves. And so really he was upset with how they were thieving or trying to make too much money and being unfair economically at the temple. But that's not the point. When you read it in context, that's just not God's point here.
That's right.
They were a den of thieves because they were they were a den of thieves, and a den is a hideout.
That's right.
It's a place where thieves go to hide after they've done the thieving.
After they've done all the once they've committed all of their crimes.
Yes.
That's where they hide.
They find a place of safety.
Yes.
To get away from the law. And so he's saying you are out there living immoral lives as
That's right.
you know, murderers, slanderers, and gossips. You are thieves. You are oppressing the people you're called to help. But then you come here as though it's your private den.
Yes.
Your gangster's hideout where you
right.
can hang out and say, ah, good, we're far from the long arm of the law. And that only makes you feel more safe and secure so that you can go back out there into your life of sin. And he says, I won't have it. Your religion, your ritual service to me should actually be out there helping the poor, not coming here and saying this is enough. Which really reminds me of what James says. It's
yes.
the only place in the Bible the word religion is used positively. And James says, you know,
yes.
the only religion God cares about is going out there and helping the orphans
yes.
and the widows, those who are in need. But God was saying that in a different way, at a different phase, all the way back in the middle of the Old Testament.
Yeah, and you can see there in Jeremiah, the context of that den of thieves, it's a holistic view of life. It's not just one sin or another. What he's saying, again, it's that hideout where you have a guilty conscience and you're looking for a safe place to escape. In a sense, again, we go back to what we talked about right at the beginning.
Yeah.
We like to create sacred space
yeah.
to contain God,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
That we can go out and do what we want, and then we retreat there.
Yeah.
We have a feeling like he's okay with us because we've created this
yes,
place,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
And it becomes that hideout for us where we actually, our guilty consciences are appeased because we've went through a ritual, we have reconnected through the sacred space.
Yeah. yeah.
And so we can see in...
we're just being handed a note.
Oh, a special note
special
that
note.
Is telling the podcast needs to come to a close.
Come to a close. Okay, all right.
Well,
it's been good having you by.
It's been good having you here, and I think we didn't get to that place of brainstorming. Maybe we should take just a minute or two to do that.
Okay.
And that is, okay, that's them then.
Right.
What about us now?
Yeah.
If God was to walk in to our communities and into my life,
yeah,
and say, okay, Tim, where are you at with this?
Yeah.
Where am I hiding out?
Right.
Where's my sacred hideout?
Yeah. We all stumble. We all fail. James also says that in chapter 3. We all stumble in many ways. But there's a difference between stumbling while you're trying to walk forward and stumbling, mm-hmm. and someone who has just built for themselves a new system, a new pattern of going to some religious ritual or to some sacred space in their lives so they can feel safe and secure and better, and then going back, and whether it's just screwing other people at business,
yes,
or it's just screwing other people or whatever it may be, you know? I mean, it's just going out with an unchanged character.
That's right.
Having been with God and turning that into our own system. It's just an insult to the God who loves us and has called us to a better life.
That's right. And I think that is the, again, you look at Jesus' life. It isn't just saying, you know, sacred are man or human made sacred spaces are okay.
Yeah.
Keep them around.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Build your sacred buildings and then just go out and try to live it.
Mm.
Because of that tendency that we have,
yeah,
to overvalue our own experience,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
that we feel close to God,
yeah,
we actually have to be extremely cautious with any sense, oh, yeah, of creating sacred space.
You're right.
Because it has this way of duping us, like, yeah, it said in the passage.
Yeah.
You know, those are deceptive words.
Mm, yeah.
They're self-deceptive words,
yeah,
to believe that God has somehow baptized us, sanctified us because, yeah, we've been in some sort of place where we feel something.
Yeah.
Rather, we have to tear them down and say, no, I am sacred space.
Yeah.
And then I go back into my job.
Yeah.
And right?
I'm taking that space with me.
And I have to live out of that space,
yeah,
Monday to Friday, whether I'm at home with my kids playing,
yeah. Yeah.
Or how I respond to my wife or to a close friend or to the neighbor across the street.
Yeah.
How am I living that's out good, of sacred space?
We don't want to be blanketly critical of churches that have sanctuaries and altars and big Bibles and a crucifix or a cross at the front. But we do think it is right, brother to brother, Christian to Christian, to point out the dangers.
That's right.
And say, this is, you're playing with fire here with the human psyche.
That's right.
Right? Yeah. You're actually perhaps working against your ability to go out and live the life of Christ.
That's
in
right.
The way you should. Because you're surrounded, I mean, you're trying to live it out there while you're building a special place that has all the cues,
right,
all the visual and traditional cues that says, no, there's a special place where
that's
God lives.
Right.
And so you're actually fighting against yourself. Our church, we meet in a warehouse at one site and in movie theaters at other sites. And every so often, a visitor, usually who has a church background, will say, but where's your crosses? Where's your iconography? Where are the things you have done to try and turn this into a real church,
yeah,
instead of just some space where you guys happen to meet? But and maybe other Christians can be stronger at that than we can. But our response is there's just no such thing as sacred
that's
space.
Right.
And the more we make the place we meet on Sundays into some special holy space, and we give those cues to ourselves, the more we're working against us fulfilling the Great Commission of Christ and carrying Him to others.
Exactly. Maybe a practical illustration from the home. Do you know, when you talk about giving the wrong visual cues,
yeah,
or the wrong mental,
yes,
cues, how,
yeah,
that can play with us?
Yes.
Just think about this. If at home you didn't call your house home, but called your house family, and then called your living room not your living room, but your love room.
So,
you know, welcome to my family.
Right.
And then come on into my love room. And so then everybody who comes in knows this is the room where
love is.
Love is, yeah, inside our family.
Inside the family, yeah.
And you're like, no. You're messing with the concepts. You're getting the concepts fundamentally wrong.
Yeah. Family and house are two different things.
Two different things. Yeah. And love and living together are two different things.
Yeah.
And so you want my kids to love everywhere.
Yes, right.
Right?
Right.
Not just in the family room.
Right, that's right.
Right? And the house is just a house. It's, yeah, not my family.
Yeah.
But you see how just even using that as an example,
like the word of church,
yeah, and just how we play with words,
yeah,
can continually remind us of the wrong things.
You're right. Because the word church, again, the equivalent for those who you know, kind of new to investigating scriptural things, the word church would be the equivalent of the word family.
Yes.
Not the word home or house.
That's right.
The word, although we use it today to refer to the building, is just not how it's used in the Bible.
That's right.
It's the people, period.
Right.
And then you can live in a house, a condo, an apartment. You can go camping. You're still family when you're
That's
in a
right.
tent, when you're out. It's just, yeah, the people are what it's about.
So here we are. At the end of the chapter on sacred space, any final words, Bruxy?
No, I tell you, this has been great, Tim. It's been rich. You're good family.
You're good family,
I
brother.
I feel close to you right now. I feel there's a thin space between us.
Well, you know, you're going to be just as close to me even when I go to my next appointment.
Okay, good.
So just so you know that.
All right,
well, we're secure, brother.
That's good. I'll let you go then. Hey, thank you, everyone, for listening. Just a reminder, we would love to hear from you, find out where you're at, what you're listening from, and hear any questions you might have or just feedback. And you can check out more information about this podcast and about the book at theendofreligion.org. Or you can write us at feedback@theendofreligion.org. feedback@theendofreligion.org. It would be wonderful if you just take a moment next time you're by your computer, fire off a quick email, let us know that you're listening and where you're listening from and how you stumbled upon us. We're just always interested in that kind of stuff.
Till next time.
Till next time.
Adios. We never know how to end.
No,
so this
right.
is goodbye.
That was it. Bye.